the ninth morning session of the ninth Federalist Faculty Conference, and we're going to have a panel on new directions in originalism. And before introducing the panel, I just thought I'd take a few words to try to dispel what many might think is a kind of oxymoronic flavor of the title, New Directions in Originalism. After all, originalism is what is tried and true, and what can be new about it. Let me say, let me divide my remarks into two parts. One is, well, why should we have a renewed focus on originalism, and why might you think it's useful to think about what's new about it? I think originalism is on the march, and why, and is getting greater credence in the legal academy, and why is that the case? I think there are really two reasons. One, I don't want to say that all members of the legal academy are power worshippers, but certainly power is an important consideration into what academics, certainly applied academics like legal academics, write about. And we actually now have originalists on the Supreme Court. Of course, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas. And one prediction I'd have, where I guess we're still in the few days after the first of the year, we can make predictions, in that 2007, it will emerge that Justice Alito is a third originalist on the Supreme Court. And that is, I think that may be the greatest number of self-proclaimed originalists we've ever had on the court. The second may be more important than that, and that is, I think, the fevers of postmodernism in the academy in general have been running their course, and the idea of a more objective historical truth, I think, has been rising. I think, moreover, even the events of 9/11 have been a motivator of patriotism and a focus on objective moral right and wrong. And these matters, I think, as well, are moving away from some of the more postmodern trends in the academy and are contributing to a revival of originalism. Well, I guess the second question is, well, even if there's a revival of originalism, why can't we just look at the few articles that have been written about originalism and stand on those? Well, I think there are two reasons that I think are focusing on new ideas about originalism. And one is the first observation I made. We now have two and probably three originalists on the Supreme Court, and there's variation among them in the kind of originalism they adopt. Justice Scalia has a bright line rule originalism. Justice Thomas seems to have a different kind of originalism, and Justice Alito may have yet a third kind of originalism. That variation requires some theorizing about which kind of originalism is right. And the second reason is the changing nature of the legal academy. The legal academy has become much more focused on theoretical understandings of why one should adopt one mode of interpretation rather than another. If one looks 50, 60 years ago, really at any kind of scholarship, it seems woefully, to use the worst kind of criticism one can make of an academic today, under-theorized. And therefore, originalism really hasn't gone through the deep theoretical inquiries, the hard interrogation that most ideas go through in the modern legal academy. I think that's another reason why it's appropriate to think about new ideas in originalism. And in particular, I think there are two areas that we'll hear about today. One is, what is the justification for originalism? Are there new justifications for originalism other than some of the old ones? Well, the idea that the framers were originalists and we should be originalists too, or that originalism constrains judges. And the second question is, even if you've justified originalism, what's the content of originalism? Originalism, even before this era, has gone, I think, undergone some changes. We began, I think, before the 1980s, with an idea of original intent, the idea that we should follow the intent of the framers. That changed, I think, with the rise of Reagan and the Mies Justice Department to an understanding of original meaning. Let's look at the original meaning of the text. Are there new ways, though, of understanding how to arrive at that meaning? What is the role of the framers' own interpretive rules? Those, I think, are important positive questions about the nature and the content of originalism. Well, I think we have some wonderful participants in today's panels. We have two people who've written books, Randy Barnett of Georgetown Law School, who's written The Constitution of Liberty, which touches on these questions, and Kermit Roosevelt at the University of Pennsylvania, who's written The Myth of Judicial Activism, which focuses also a lot on originalism. I'm also grateful to have two friends of mine from the Justice Department who I know have been thinking about these questions for at least 20 years, Mike Rappaport of the University of San Diego. And if I may make a point of personal privilege, kind reference was made last evening to some work of mine on supermajority rules. And, of course, Mike is every bit as responsible for that as I am, for good or for ill. And John Harrison, I think I need to say no more than he is really the perfect knight of formalism, and we're very grateful to have him speaking last here. So first of all, I'll introduce Randy Barnett, and we'll speak around 8 to 10 minutes in a kind of introductory format, and then I'll let the speakers talk amongst themselves, and then we'll open it up to questions from the audience. Randy.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here at how many? Is this the ninth faculty symposium? These are fantastic events. And I feel really, really terrible about the fact that I have to leave this event early because I have a conflict with a program I'm on at the other conference that goes nameless. And it just goes to show my relative priorities on these two conferences is that I'm part of the planning committee for this conference and put together the helped put together the program and helped, certainly agreed to the schedule, and had completely forgotten that I had committed to be on a program at the AALS, which is why I didn't check to see if I had a conflict, because I just didn't realize until a few weeks ago that I was reminded, oh, you're on this program. Okay. So anyway, but as a result, I do have to be there at the beginning of the program, and I have to run off. This is a great topic. I really appreciate John's opening remarks. He preempted a good deal of what I had in mind to say or would have wanted to say and thought I wouldn't be able to be for want of time. I agree with most everything that John says in the opening, including his observation that originalism is, number one, gaining a lot of steam, and number two, highly under-theorized and needs to be better theorized. And as an sort of exhibit number one of how originalism is gaining steam, I wanted to bring to your attention something I think many of you have heard of, but I'm sure some of you haven't, and that is that in a forthcoming article in Constitutional Commentary called Originalism and Abortion, Jack Balkin of Yale Law School, who I think all of you will agree is one of the leading lights of the left, the self-described left of legal academy, has made the startling disclosure that he is now an originalist. And he's not doing it tongue-in-cheek. I've already seen people smiling about this. But I think he's being sincere. And here's how he describes this position now. I'm quoting Balkin. Constitutional interpretation, he writes, requires fidelity to the original meaning of the Constitution and to the principles that underlie the text. The task of interpretation is to look to original meaning and underlying principle and decide how best to apply them in current circumstances. I call this method text and principle. And I think that this intellectual development is huge. Jack is one of the most consistently creative and innovative progressive constitutional law theorists of our day. And that he has been pulled by the gravitational force of originalism is a major development, I think. And I have a critical piece I'm going to mention a little bit about his article that's coming out in Constitutional Commentary. They're putting together a symposium on his issue. But if you think that this is some kind of minor development, I think that it's not going to be thought to be a minor development on the left itself. And as evidence for this, I'll cite the opening of another comment that's going to be in the Constitutional Commentary issue along with Jack's paper by a junior professor at Hastings named Ethan Lieb, who opens his remarks as follows. I've read these remarks last night. I just found out about them last night, and they're very, very good. But here's how he opens up his comments. He says, "It certainly seems like originalists are winning. Jack Balkin, finding that he couldn't beat him, joined him." living constitutionalists used to turn to Balkin as a reliable advocate. He recently wrote, and this was from 2005, "We are all living constitutionalists now, but Balkin has forsaken them." Losing such an important advocate might be a sign that what some once deemed the ascendant and dominant theory in constitutional interpretation is on the decline. And then he says, don't count living constitutionalism out just yet. And that's a part of what his talk is. But part of what his talk is, and I recommend this to those who may doubt that Balkin has become an originalist, and I have my own doubts, which I'm going to talk about in a moment, but should read the rest of the paper, because the rest of Lee's paper is an argument for why there may be a lot of wiggle room in Balkin's new position, but ultimately he's committing himself to something that really isn't consistent with living constitutionalism, and that's why he can't just be reabsorbed into the living constitutionalism position. Okay, now I think that there are two reactions that Federalist Society, members of the Federalist Society Coalition can have to this development. The first is that they could rejoice that they are winning in the battle of ideas and consider this to be something really, really to be happy about and allow yourself one day of satisfaction over this development. This, however, is not the normal instinct of members of the Federalist Society Coalition. They're not like the happy warriors of Ronald Reagan necessarily. Probably the normal instinct of a typical member of the Federalist Society Coalition is to lash out at Jack Balkin for not being a real originalist and for somehow trying to subvert originalism and spoil the party and ruin originalism. I don't know where I got the idea that a member in good standing of the Federalist Society Coalition would have this reaction to Balkin. Maybe it was having breakfast with Mike Rappaport right after I read about Balkin and talking to him about it. And I don't think I'm directly quoting Michael's reaction at breakfast that morning, but I'm trying to paraphrasing this general idea. So the question is, how should we react? And I think it would actually be in our interest to react positively to this development and not churlishly to this development, if we can help ourselves. But secondly, I think that Balkin actually has made a major move, and it's a move that's a tribute to the power of the idea of originalism. But I do think a lot is going to depend on how he ultimately reconciles this notion of text and principle, or how he uses text and principle. I think it's undeniable that there is something like text and principle at work in a proper theory of originalism, that a text alone doesn't do the work, that you need text and context, and part of the context that's necessary to interpret the text is provided by the principles that are inherent in the text itself, that underlie the text itself. So I think he's right to identify text and principle, but a lot depends on what the relationship is between text and principle. And I'm just going to briefly, like just in 2 minutes, summarize the point I make in this longer, not much, this 10-page comment I have on Balkin. And that is, as long as you're using underlying principle to interpret the text, and then you apply the text so interpreted to cases and controversies, then I think you're fairly within originalism. But that's not the way text and principle. There's another way of using text and principle, and I think the other way of using text and principle is precisely non-originalist. It's precisely what really amounts to living constitutionalism, and why living constitutionalists believe they are being faithful to the Constitution, and their self-understanding is that they are being faithful to the Constitution. And that is, you look to the underlying principle of the text, and you may accurately discern the underlying principle of the text. Then you forget about the text and start applying the underlying principle to future cases and controversies, even where doing so goes way beyond the text or contradicts the text. And that's where you start hearing about how, well, the text is somewhat archaic. It was a 200-year-old text, and of course it couldn't anticipate the future. And if you look at the underlying principles of the text and you apply those to the future, now of course you've got something going. And that really is the sort of the hallmark of non-originalism. That is the hallmark of living constitutionalism. So it turns out Jack's identification of text and principle as a key way of organizing the moving parts of an interpretation theory is correct. And there are parts in his paper in which he looks as though he's doing the living constitution version of text and principle, not the originalist version of text and principle. The originalist version of text and principle is to go down through the text into the underlying principle where you need to, and then come back up through the same text that you went down in, as opposed to going down in the text and coming up wherever else you may wish to come up. And we'll see how he responds to this comment. We'll see how he practices it in the future. He could back away in this respect, but that, I think, is what we should be watching for. I would say, however, that if you view Balkin as a non-originalist because he uses underlying principle to get to results that the text doesn't get to you all by itself, then I think you're going to have to also conclude that Justice Scalia is not an originalist as well. I think if you make this move against Balkin, you're going to have to make the same move against Justice Scalia. I actually think until we see what Jack does, this is a more justified move to make with Justice Scalia than it has so far with Jack Balkin. And the reason is that if you read Justice Scalia's Taft lecture, in which the originalism, the lesser evil, and then you see how he's practiced originalism on the bench, he explicitly in his Taft lecture gives himself not one, not two, but three ways of discarding original meaning or original meaning when, and in his in the framework of the Taft lecture, when the results are not right. I mean, it is in term his Taft lecture is framed in terms of objectionable results, objectionable even to an originalist like himself. And his three outs are, first of all, it's the rule of how did you describe it, John? You had a nice way of putting it in your talk.
Bright lineism.
If the text is not provide a bright line, if the text is something other than a bright line, then and the original meaning of the text is something other than a bright line, then judges have to ignore that part of the text, and they have to ignore the original meaning of that text. So you only get to, under this view of bright lineism, to enforce portions of the Constitution, not the whole Constitution. I think that, whether or not that's defensible or not, it's, I think, a movement away from originalism, where originalism gives you results you don't like. The second is when he resorts to precedent. Precisely in the circumstances when originalism doesn't give him results he likes, then he looks to precedent that does give him results he likes. But what is precedent other than the dead hand of judges who have moved on to a greater reward? They've left behind these written opinions, which now are going to govern us from the grave. And personally, I'm no more sanguine about judge. I would much rather be judged, governed by the dead founders than the dead judges. And I do think that when you appeal to precedent as an out, and you don't like the results of doctrine, then you're not being an originalist. And finally, the last out he gives himself in the Taft lecture is when he just doesn't like the results. You just don't. You just, when the results are just so bad, you just don't follow originalism. So, I mean, he actually has a result-oriented result out in this. And I do believe it, and I try to make an argument in this. I gave the Taft lecture at University of Cincinnati last year, and I made the subject of my Taft lecture Justice Scalia's Taft lecture. And in my piece, I do try to show how when he practices originalism on the bench, he does pretty much the same thing, which is when the outcome more or less in agreement with him, he goes with originalism. When he doesn't like it, he does these. He appeals to one of these other moves. And Justice Thomas is really distinguishable from Justice Scalia in this regard. Justice Thomas, as Justice Scalia has noted, you know, thinks originalism should, for example, top precedent. And Justice Scalia objects to that, and Justice Thomas does not. And I think that's a huge difference between the two of them. At any rate, I really don't have any great stake in saying that Justice Scalia is not an originalist. In fact, it pains me to say so because I do credit Justice Scalia with making the most important methodological move that originalists have made. He did it a long time ago. He did it while John Harrison was in the Justice Department, and that is he's the one. And that was a long time ago, right, John?
And he remembers that far.
I don't know. It's really hard. As mind of the man, memory of the man runneth. Not. So at any rate, he did it when a lot of originalists in those days were talking about original intent, and Justice Scalia, when he was on the D.C. Circuit and attending these nefarious meetings that were being held at the Justice Department, said, you know, no, you guys are making a big mistake. It's original meaning. It's not original intent. And I think there are good intellectual reasons. Ideas have consequences, and there are good intellectual reasons why Justice Scalia rightly urged this shift, and others followed, and I think it's now pretty much the consensus that that's what we should be doing. But I do think that ideas have consequences, and the shift from original intent was adopted for a reason, and I think partly that reason was political. not just because it was the philosophically best theory of interpretation, but it yielded results that the people who promoted originalism wanted to see. And original meaning was done in response to a move made in response to criticisms of original intent that were correct and accurate and taking hold. And original meaning was a good response to that. However, the shift to original public meaning from original framers' intent had consequences. And part of the consequences are that it makes originalism a little more congenial to people who like progressive results, not just people who like conservative results, like Jack Balkin and like Kim Roosevelt, and allows a somewhat bigger tent. I don't think it gives I really don't believe it gives progressives all the results they want, and I believe you're going to see Jack Balkin admit as much if asked, for example, about the meaning of the Second Amendment. I've already asked him, and I know that he takes a non-progressive view of the Second Amendment. But I do think it also is going to originalism also provides some answers that conservatives don't want to hear as well. And then the question is, will they stay with originalism even when it's not giving them the answers that they want to hear, or at least all the answers that they want to hear? And that really will be a new development in originalism if the positions completely flip around, won't it? Thanks.
Next, we'll hear from Professor Roosevelt.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to follow Randy, who has not only preempted some of my remarks, but also outed me as a progressive representative here. So in some ways, I'm coming at this from a contrarian perspective, but I'm going to try to be conciliatory. And the theme of my remarks really is, can't we all get along? I'm a relative newcomer to the originalism living constitution debate, and the thing that's puzzled me the most about it is why there isn't more common ground. And perhaps there is now. Perhaps this is one of the things that Balkin's conversion foreshadows. But what I want to do here is I want to explore what I think the common ground is. And in order to do that, I'm going to start by describing what I think originalists and living constitutionalists want. And then I'm going to argue that these desires are in fact compatible. Now, I might be wrong in my characterizations, and I'll also offer some things that I think the two sides want that neither can have. So I don't suppose that I have a complete peace treaty here, but I hope that it might be the beginnings of a ceasefire. So, what do originalists want? Well, there are lots of different kinds of originalists, and I can't speak for everyone. I can speak for myself. I consider myself an originalist of a sort, much in the same way that Jack Balkin does, I think. But I hope that what I think of as the core notions of originalism sound reasonable. So originalism, as I think about it, wants what Justice Scalia calls the dead constitution, or when he's being less puckish, the enduring constitution. And that is basically a document whose meaning changes when Article 5 amendments are introduced and not otherwise. In particular, not just when judges or legal elites think it would be a good idea. And I think originalists should be able to have this. I think it's evident from the Constitution's design, and perhaps simply from its nature as a written document, that it is intended to have a fixed meaning, and it is supposed to be changed through the Article 5 process. That certain words might come to have different meanings as time goes by should not have the effect of changing the meaning of the Constitution. That's really absurd. It would suggest, for instance, that if the word disinterested comes to be understood as uninterested rather than impartial, a constitutional provision requiring disinterested jurors should be understood to demand that they be bored and inattentive. But subjecting the meaning of the Constitution to the contingencies of diction is not actually what living constitutionalists want. What they want, put briefly, is changed outcomes, right? They want a case that was once decided one way, say, Cumming against School Board of Richmond County, the 1899 application of Plessy to public schools, to come out a different way when it's litigated in 1953 as Brown v. Board of Education. So originalists, as I've described them, want constant meaning. And living constitutionalists want changed outcomes. And there the battle lines are drawn, except that it's quite possible that in many cases we're all on the same side. It's quite possible for a constitution to have a constant meaning but direct changed outcomes. Now, how is that possible? Well, to illustrate the theoretical possibility, the example I like to use is the latest fashions clause, which I made up. So it doesn't exist, but imagine it does exist. Imagine it's in Article 1. It says that senators, while engaged in debate, shall wear the latest fashions. Now, this requires a certain set of behaviors in 1789. What about 2007? Do senators have to wear knee breeches and powdered wigs? Well, I would say no. I would say it's clear from the purpose that we can impute to that clause that it's supposed to have a flexible range of applications. So that's supposed to show the theoretical possibility. And the real-world question, of course, is which of the provisions in the actual Constitution should also be understood this way. That's a hard question. It really needs to be asked in the context of particular provisions. But I think there are a couple of things that I can say generally about it. First, when you've got a provision whose application is highly sensitive to factual context, that should probably be flexible. And what I'm thinking of here is something like the Fourth Amendment prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures. What's reasonable, of course, depends on circumstances. And as background facts change, when, for instance, we develop small weapons that can be concealed in a pocket and kill a police officer from a distance, it may become reasonable to pat down suspects when it wasn't before. And I think that people generally agree on this. Since reasonableness is very context sensitive, you really have to make that decision in the context that exists now, not some imaginary context from 1789. Otherwise, the Fourth Amendment will not strike a sensible balance between individual liberty and official security. And you can say similar things about, for instance, speedy trial or excessive bail. But I also think that this is a reasonable approach to value-laden provisions. Now, this is something that people have more resistance to, because there seems to be an intuitive sense that while it's okay for changed facts to produce changed outcomes, it's not okay for changed values to do so. But the thing to keep in mind here is that the line between facts and values is not as sharp as you might think. So factual beliefs underlie value judgments, and changes in those facts will frequently produce changes in the value judgments. So if, for instance, you believe that the natural timidity and delicacy of woman evidently unfits her for many of the occupations of civil life, then of course it's okay to exclude women from the practice of law. If you believe that there are biological differences between blacks and whites that make it impossible to educate them together, then of course it's okay to segregate schools. But if you don't believe these things anymore, then it looks like this is discrimination without justification. It's arbitrary. And perhaps it's invidious. It's based on beliefs about the respective capabilities of men and women, or blacks and whites, that are demeaning to blacks and women and that are false. So it's looking more like a badge of inferiority. And if you believe that the Equal Protection Clause forbids arbitrary or invidious discrimination or badges of inferiority, then it's pretty easy to say these things are unconstitutional. So to put this slightly more generally, right, we could say, we can come to see that some forms of discrimination are invidious, even though the ratifiers of the Equal Protection Clause did not understand or intend that they be prohibited. Now, I know that sounds like living constitutionalist mumbo-jumbo. And the way Ronald Dworkin puts it, for instance, saying that we can come to a deeper understanding of the concept of equality, it sounds sort of pretentious too, right? It sounds as though judges should be philosophers and cases should come out the way Dworkin wants because he's the smartest philosopher of all. But that's not really what I'm saying, right? What I'm saying is if the justification for discrimination is some factual belief that turns out to be false, then it's turned out that the discrimination is unjustified and quite possibly unconstitutional. In a way that's entirely consistent with asserting that the meaning of the Equal Protection Clause has not changed. So, to that extent, I think this is much like the analysis of reasonableness under the Fourth Amendment. A harder case, what about pure value judgments? Right? What if the reason for some form of discrimination is not, say, that gays and lesbians are mentally diseased and contagious or predatory, right? The facts that used to underlie discrimination against them, but just that they're sort of morally icky. Well, again, I think if you're asking whether a particular form of discrimination is reasonable or justified, you need to look at what contemporary society thinks is reasonable rather than what people thought in 1868. Now, obviously, there are objections that would arise at this point. I can't address all of them. I probably haven't thought of all of them. But here are a couple, right? One standard objection to this line of argument would be, well, doesn't that give too much discretion to judges to impose their own values? My response to that is, well, you know, historical originalism is not necessarily all that constraining in that regard either. If the objection is it's too hard to figure out what society thinks is reasonable, it's not necessarily a solution to say, well, instead we're going to figure out what society thought was reasonable 140 years ago. And, of course, you can look at objective indicia to make this decision, right? You can look at state laws, you can look at state court constitutional decisions, and you can say at some point, you know, depending on what quantum of evidence you think is necessary, now, you know, we have these objective indicators saying that the national will has turned against a certain form of discrimination. And this, of course, is exactly what happens between Bowers and Lawrence. Another standard objection here would be, why would we want a provision that works this way? Why would we want an anti-discrimination provision that allows discrimination if some kind of national majority thinks it's reasonable? Who does that protect? And this is something that Scalia brings up, right? If you have a flexible range of applications, he says, you don't really have the kind of protection you want from the Constitution. That's a valid point. But what the Equal Protection Clause would be doing on this understanding is it would be protecting local minorities, right? It would work to bring outlier states into line with the national consensus. It ensures that the will of the nation prevails over the will of state-level majorities. And if I were a member of the Reconstruction Congress, I would think that's actually a fairly sensible thing to do. So what I've suggested is there are some clauses that you could read this way. I think applying them in this way is consistent with a reasonable intent that you could impute to the drafters and the ratifiers. Now, I could be wrong, right? I could be wrong about how they were understood and intended to be applied. But I wouldn't be wrong, I think, as an a priori matter, right? I would be wrong sort of as a historical matter. I would be wrong about the meaning of these provisions, which is to say, this is a question not of interpretive methodology, but really of meaning. So what I've tried to show is I can stand here, I can call myself an originalist, and I can still get many of the results that living constitutionalists want. Originalists, of course, want some of these too, right? They want Brown, they want Loving, I think. So there's a fair amount of common ground on which we can all get what we want. How much time do I have left?
Around a minute or so.
A minute? Okay.
A minute and a half.
Okay, well, good. So I do have enough time, I think, to say a little bit about what the two sides want that I think they can't get. Originalists, I sometimes think, want a methodology that constrains judges by revealing clearly correct answers. And this is the line that some people take when they're criticizing the living constitutionalists, right? Originalism is the correct methodology. It gives you right answers. So anyone who does something else is ignoring the right answer and probably being an activist. This is something I think originalism really can't get. The history of controversial constitutional provisions, and even some less controversial ones, shows substantial disagreement about what their consequences will be, and even post-ratification disagreement among their supporters. Two examples would be the bank controversy, which divides Madison and Hamilton, or the more recent ERA, where you can find constitutional law professors testifying that it will abolish single-sex bathrooms, it will require the drafting of women into combat, and it will require recognition of same-sex marriage. So the bottom line there is I don't think that interpretive methodologies constrain to the extent that some people hope they will. The constraints on the Supreme Court are probably more political and professional, which is to say the Supreme Court is kept in tune to some degree with popular opinion and the views of the elected branches, and to some degree with elite legal opinion. If both of those turn against it, it's eventually going to fold. What the hardcore living constitutionalists want but can't have, I'm a little bit less certain of. Maybe I'll talk about that in the question-answer session. I've had some discussions with Mitch Berman, and I read Ethan Leib's piece, which I think is interesting but seems a little bit crazy to me, actually. But my basic point is both originalists and living constitutionalists can get a lot of what they want through an interpretive methodology that is originalist with respect to meaning and sees meaning as fixed, but understands that fixed meaning is not incompatible with changed outcomes. Once you accept that point, most of your disputes, I think, should be disputes about constitutional meaning. That is, they should not be about interpretive methodology at all.
Thank you, John. Okay, the new direction in originalism that I'd like to talk about today is a new normative argument for originalism that John McGinnis and I have developed over a couple of papers in the last several years. Now, while modern originalism has been developing for a period of time, most modern originalists really just focus in on doing originalism. They don't defend it all that much. Now, there have been some defenders, and I think Randy here is certainly an exception, have basically argued that originalism is good because it constrains judges and it protects democracy and the like. And what I want to do is present a new argument for originalism. It's not really that originalism would lead to constraints on judges. It's actually that originalism is likely to lead to better outcomes. Better outcomes than alternative interpretive methodologies would provide, including the living constitution. And the reason for this is that the constitution was enacted under a set of strict supermajority rules, which make it likely that it would be a desirable constitution. Thus, when we simply enforce the constitution that was written, we're actually likely to get good outcomes. We don't have to choose between constraining the discretion of judges and getting good outcomes. Enforcing the original meaning of a supermajoritarian enacted constitution gets us both. Okay. Now, let me summarize my argument in three steps, and then I'll go into and develop each of these steps a bit more. So, three steps. First step. The enactment of a constitution under appropriate supermajority rules is likely to lead to a desirable constitution, one that preserves democratic decision-making, individual rights, protects the public interest. That's the first step. Second step, the supermajority rules that actually govern the enactment of and the amendment of our constitution are in the main appropriate ones and have in fact led to a pretty desirable constitution. And third, in order for this constitution to have its desirable character, we've actually got to give it the original meaning. Because it's that meaning that the drafters and the ratifiers employed in deciding whether to enact this constitution through the supermajoritarian processes. Okay, so first point, what are the appropriate supermajority rules? The appropriate supermajority rules lead to a desirable constitution. I don't really have time to go through and work out the argument in detail. It can a lot of aspects to it, but let me just give you enough to give you a sort of a flavor of the argument. And I think the easiest way to suggest the connection between a supermajoritarian enactment and desirable outcome is to compare a majority rule enactment and supermajority rule enactment. While using majority rule to enact constitutional provisions is probably not a good idea, in my view, definitely not a good idea, strict supermajority rule is actually likely to get you a good constitution. In part because they solve some of the problems that majoritarian enactment would get you, and they compensate for other problems. And I'll make clear what I mean by that in a second. So, first, one feature of a good constitution is going to be that it's going to be supported by a consensus. This is going to be especially important in a pluralistic country like the United States, where we use our constitution as a kind of source of unity, as a source of allegiance. But if the Constitution could get enacted by simply majority rule, then you could have a large minority that would be strongly opposed to the Constitution, and this would be a great source of national division in the country. By contrast, if you have to get the Constitution enacted by strict supermajority rules, you're much more likely to get a Constitution that is supported by a consensus of the people. Of course, we don't only want to have a Constitution that's supported by consensus. We also want to get one that actually has desirable constitutional provisions that protect important rights, that provide for a sort of wise, sensible government decision-making. You know, once again, majority rules are not a good way of enacting such a constitution, but supermajority rules would be. One problem with majoritarian enactment is partisanship, right? One party, the majority party, has control over the process, then they're very likely to use that control to enact constitutional provisions that would serve their own party's interests at the expense of the public. By contrast, under supermajority rules, you can't get this kind of partisanship, because what you need to have is you not be able to pass anything that doesn't have the support of at least some members of both parties. Now, another reason why majoritarian enactment is unlikely to produce desirable constitutional provisions is a result of the long-term nature of constitutional provisions. Constitutional provisions are difficult to repeal, and that means they need to be designed to last for a long time. But this sort of long-term nature creates problems, and let me just mention one of the problems. We actually know this from some of the more recent cognitive psychology literature, but people have a tendency to believe that the future is going to be very much like the present. And if that's true, that's going to lead to a tendency to pass constitutional provisions, or to want to pass constitutional provisions, that it may make sense under the existing circumstances, but are not going to make sense over changed circumstances. Now, supermajority rules are not going to directly solve that problem of not anticipating the future, but they do offset it by improving the quality of the of the constitutional provisions in other ways. So, for example, when constitutional provisions are enacted under a supermajority rule, and when you can't repeal those constitutional provisions except through a supermajority rule, then they're enacted under a kind of veil of ignorance, because they're going to last a long time. It's going to be difficult for people to figure out how these provisions are going to affect them over the long run. Circumstances are going to change, how it's going to affect them and their family and the like. And as a result, they're going to have more of an incentive to evaluate these constitutional provisions from a kind of impartial perspective, rather than trying to figure out whether it's going to help them. They're not really going to be so sure about that. Instead, whether it's going to be just make sense in general, which is, as a result, more likely to get us a desirable constitutional provision. Now, this argument for supermajority rules, or for this argument about supermajority rules, I guess, not only explains why I think the Constitution is desirable, but it also supports originalism. Because the drafters and ratifiers used the original meaning of the Constitution in deciding whether to enact that Constitution and whether to pass it through the supermajoritarian process it had to go through, the Constitution's only going to have the desirable characteristics of that process if it's given that original meaning. They wouldn't have been able to anticipate some alternative new meaning of the Constitution. It wouldn't have gone through the supermajoritarian process, only the original meaning that would have gone through it. This explanation for the desirability of the Constitution is also going to tell us the type of originalism that we should use. It suggests that we should use the same interpretive rules that the framers would have applied to the Constitution. Now, while using originalism to interpret a constitution, the constitution enacted by supermajority rules, is not certainly a perfect method, the real question is whether it's better than the alternative methods, and I believe that it clearly is. I think we can see really the superiority of it by comparing how we get constitutional norms under the originalism method as compared to a method, let's say, through the living constitution method, and looking at the process. Under the living constitution method, within some limit, and you know, Kim has talked about a little bit about this, but depending on the version you use, essentially 9 elite lawyers in Washington, D.C., decide what constitutional norms we should have based on a majority vote. And by contrast, under the constitutional enactment and amendment provisions of the Constitution, we get constitutional norms through a broad cross-section of the nation uses strict supermajority rules to get them. I think the superiority there is evident. The framers' originalism is also going to be superior to these new theories of constitutional interpretation of originalism, such as Jack Balkin's or Kim's, because while these theories purport to be originalist, I don't think that they employ the interpretive rules that the framers would have applied to the Constitution, and therefore we're not going to get the actual Constitution that's enacted through the supermajoritarian process being enforced under these interpretive rules. All right, well, let me conclude by discussing what two possible criticisms you might make of the theory. I know there's more than that, but the first one is you might argue, well, the supermajoritarian process, yes, it could possibly lead to desirable constitutional provisions when the Constitution is enacted in 1789, but it's now more than 200 years later. And there's no reason to think that we'll have desirable constitutional provisions at this point. I simply don't think that's true. And maybe the way to think about this is to think about it in terms of a rate of constitutional decay, or a rate of decay of constitutional provisions. If a constitution is well framed, and as we would think it would be if it's enacted under strict supermajority rules, the provisions in it are not going to decay quickly, because they would have been designed to take into account changing circumstances. And I would say, actually, the U.S. Constitution has held up remarkably well on this regard, precisely because the framers were aware of this issue, of the need for a permanent constitution, of the fact that circumstances are going to change. And they only placed in the Constitution the very most important restrictions. And so they really left a lot of play for circumstances to change and be taken into account by the political process. Of course, in some cases, you are going to have constitutional provisions that decay. The most serious problem is going to be able to be handled with a constitutional amendment process, but you're certainly not going to be able to take into account everything. Right? There are going to be some provisions that are at least going to be mildly undesirable that you're not going to be able to get a constitutional amendment to fix, right? And I think the only thing you can say about it is that these provisions are costs of they're clear costs, and they're costs of a supermajoritarian method that the benefits of which outweigh, right? They're just simply outweighed by the fact that in general you're going to get beneficial provisions from the supermajoritarian method, and that if you have to live with these costs, the alternative, you know, changing the meaning of the Constitution by judges and the like, is going to have even greater costs. But we shouldn't think that, you know, the Constitution's perfect or that the amendment process doesn't have costs. It certainly does. They're just limited. Now, the second criticism that you can make that I at least want to discuss is that the constitutional enactment process might be thought to have been defective because it excluded blacks. It also excluded women and others, but I'm just going to talk about blacks. And this is certainly true. In fact, that the supermajority rules excluded, that supermajority rules were employed but excluded blacks is actually helps to explain why the Constitution that we got did such a very good job for whites and didn't do such a good job for blacks, right? I guess the short answer to this whole, the, to this problem is that, happily, for modern purposes, the exclusion of blacks has now been corrected. Right? The 14th and the Civil War amendments generally have provided blacks with the same civil and voting rights that white males enjoy. And so now you can say that the Constitution has been corrected in this regard.
Very nice. Mr. Harrison.
Thank you, John, and thank you for organizing this panel. And I noticed that in his introduction, John managed some over-the-top praise for a number of us. He characterized Randy Barnett's book as the Constitution of Liberty, thereby conferring the Nobel Prize on Randy. He knighted me. Thank you. Thank you for that, John. Expressed agreement, of course, with Mike Rappaport, his co-author. I think you owe Kim Roosevelt some kind of props, John, at this point. I don't know if you have any more knighthoods to go out, but perhaps he should get one, too. Originalism is, as Randy said, under-theorized, which is surprising. That's not to say that there isn't a lot of theorizing about it. That's to say that maybe there isn't enough good theorizing about it. And so I am going to try to do a little more theorizing in a fashion that bears on the debate that normally goes by the name of originalism. Notice the qualifications. Whether I'm really talking about originalism or not, I will leave you to decide for yourselves. And my first point is to say that much of the debate that goes by the name of originalism isn't really about originalism. It's about other things. One way to see that is to notice that normally original, or the source of originalism, is an adjective. Original intent, original meaning, original outcomes, original expectations. Original is the adjective, not the noun. And you would expect that most of the time, if you were having a fundamental disagreement, the disagreement would be about the noun and not about the adjective. Original has to do with the location of something in time. But the nouns tend to be of greater importance, and so if you were having a dispute as to whether meaning matters, that would be primary, and then the question whether the meaning should be original or not would be a secondary meaning. I think a lot of the debates that go by the name of originalism have that characteristic. They really are about the noun, and they're not about the adjective at all. For example, one debate that goes by this name that is sometimes characterized as the argument between originalism and the living constitution is really the debate over whether to follow the written constitution or not. And that is a very serious debate, because if you are a legal realist, or even if you are any kind of follower of H.L.A. Hart, you will say that the actual constitution, that the law is a matter of social fact, that the actual constitution of the United States is the body of fundamental and difficult to change rules that govern the way things happen now, in 2007. And that in 2007, the actual body of rules that are basic and hard to change, that govern the way things are done in this country, is related to, but is not the same as, the document that we talk about. And therefore, there is a very real debate over whether that written constitution is the constitution in H.L.A. Hart's sense. That's a fundamental and important argument. It's not about originalism. It's about the noun. It is not about the adjective. Similarly, as I think Randy pointed out, a lot of the debates that go by this name are really debates about whether to be a formalist. That is to say, whether to look to the rules in the document or to look at underlying principles. Well, what does it mean to look at underlying principles? To look at underlying principles means to deformalize whatever you are talking about, to make it less of a rule and more of a standard. Again, that is a methodological argument. It's not fundamentally a methodological argument about the location of anything in time. It's a methodological argument about whether to understand anything, any legal norm, as a rule or as a standard. Originalistic considerations can then come into the rule standards argument, the formalism argument, one reason not to be a formalist, to think of something as a standard and not a rule, may have to do with changes since the time the norm was created. But that is secondary, and it is not primary. So I think that is often the case. And with that in mind, I am going to talk about a topic that may or may not actually be about originalism narrowly conceived, that is to say, the location of things in time then as opposed to now. I should say there are important theoretical questions associated specifically with originalism, with time. One way to characterize them generally is to say if you reach back into the past for a legal norm and say by a present decision we're going to use it now, and this is Kim Roosevelt touched on this a little bit, how much of what was associated with the norm at the time when you reach back for it do you bring back with you? How many of the surrounding assumptions, factual or legal or normative, are brought back along with the norm? And you can have that argument in terms of what constitutes the meaning of the norm as opposed to parts that don't come with it. That is a debate about originalism. What I'm going to say in a moment will touch on that, but is not fundamentally about that. I'm going to pick up on something that Kermit Roosevelt said a few moments ago, and his point is a lot of the current arguments that go by the name of originalism are not about methodology at all. They are substantive arguments about the meaning of the constitutions. And going last, I'm trying to some extent to steal from everybody else in order to minimize my own preparation work. So I'm going to steal from Kim and Randy and from some extent Mike and do a little constitutional theorizing of my own right now, and attempt to argue on theoretical grounds, and so it must be true because it's true on theoretical grounds, that one thing we should not expect to see in constitutions are provisions that call on later constitutional interpreters to make large-scale normative judgments. And I think one thing about the endless debate over originalism is that I needn't explain why it's relevant to that debate whether future interpreters are being called on to make large-scale normative judgments. So much of the debate is about that I think we can just take it as, I will say, the relevance of what I'm about to say, since it's about that, ought to be fairly straightforward. So this is the theoretical argument. And it adopts, and this is a standpoint that is, I think, not adopted enough, although what Mike Rappaport was saying a few moments ago is largely from this standpoint. Think about the problem of associated with constitutions not from the standpoint, here we are, you know, we're Ulysses, the Constitution was made a long time ago, so we're Ulysses bound to the mast, talking about how terrible the things that are binding us to the mast are, what a terrible idea it is, and aren't the sirens swell. Or on the other hand, maybe we are somebody who is bound by something that really shouldn't be binding us, right? But in any event, our attitude is looking backwards, being people who are subject to a constitution, and either saying, oh, it's great, like Mike Rappaport, or saying, oh, no, what a horrible idea, because it's so old and so stupid, and wow, how about the sirens? Hey, babe. But I want to adopt the standpoint of a constitution writer, not somebody who lives under a constitution, and ask whether a constitution writer would very often adopt a norm that required large-scale normative judgments to be made by the appliers. And my basic argument is going to be no, and then I'm going to give a couple of reasons why maybe it might happen, although, as I say, the general theoretical tendency of this is to say no. And the argument runs through the various reasons why one might want to entrench a rule at all. And it's a good question. Why make constitutional rules? That is to say, why adopt rules that are then going to be really hard to change, and in particular, that can't be changed through what we frequently characterize in this context as the normal political process, that is, legislation in the United States. Why have entrenchment? What is entrenchment for? And I think if you think about the various things that entrenchment is for, rarely, if ever, would they lead somebody who was doing some entrenching to create the kind of provision, again, this turns into an argument about meaning ultimately, the kind of provision that calls on later interpreters to make very important normative judgments. And the first big reason to have entrenched rules is, of course, agency costs associated with political agents. Constitutions set up political systems. They empower politicians who will be agents of the people. But the people creating a constitution can realize, well, you know, the thing about politicians is they're just like the rest of us, and that means you cannot trust them. Give them an inch and they'll take, well, a little bit more than an inch. Agency problems are probably the primary thing that drove the design of the original Constitution in 1787, the problem that the people can't trust the government. Well, if you don't think you can trust the government, are you going to give any part of the government through the Constitution the power to make these overwhelmingly important normative judgments that can come sometimes through interpreting the Constitution? Well, that would be an odd thing to do. If you thought that your agents couldn't be trusted, then in the Constitution itself, to grant the special kind of power to the agents, not even the normal kind of power that's granted through the political process. And if you thought your Constitution was going to be implemented through judicial review, and maybe the framers did and maybe they didn't, but if you thought your Constitution was going to be implemented through judicial review, and you thought of judges as being, in important respects, most distant from the people, the least responsive of the agents, then giving them this kind of power would sort of not really fit with the whole idea of having a Constitution as a means of dealing with agency costs. So that primary reason for having entrenched rules, why is the rule about the term of the House of Representatives entrenched and not changed by the House? They might decide that a 30-year term would be a really good idea, but that might not be in the interests of their principles, the people. So that first large and most important reason for having entrenched constitutional rules, difficult to reconcile with relatively indeterminate constitutional rules. The next two, and these two I think go together, they're different forms of self-binding or pre-commitment. I hate the term pre-commitment because what is there a post-commitment? I mean I'm very grateful to Kim Roosevelt for giving the excellent example of the drift in meaning of the word disinterested as it's becoming to mean uninterested. My favorite example of meaning drift in the last few years has been the word ratchet. Which is apparently changing its meaning because since there are one-way ratchets, there must be two-way ratchets. Well, but the idea of a ratchet is that it works only one way. So what is a one-way ratchet? Disinterested and uninterested is probably a better example because you can imagine a rule that said jurors must be disinterested. And then, yeah, after most trials, many people would be. What was I talking about? Oh, yeah. I was talking about pre-commitment. That is to say, I was talking about constitutions as mechanisms of collective self-binding. And the first of the subheadings there, of course, is Ulysses and the Sirens. Ulysses, in his calm moment, decides, I really want to hear the Sirens' song because, boy, it's really interesting and nobody's ever heard the Sirens' song and lived to tell about it. But on the other hand, everybody who hears the Sirens' song dives in the water to go see the Sirens and drowns. So what can I do? I can have my men lash me to the mast and stuff their own ears with wax so they won't be able to hear the siren songs or my demands that I be untied. And there are circumstances under which collectivities may want to self-bind. Not clear that there are as many such circumstances as people sometimes think, but there are circumstances under which that would be the rational thing to do, to lay down a rule at a time when the collectivity is, relatively speaking, sober. Whether that ever happened in 18th or 19th century America is another question, given what we know about liquor consumption back then. And have that rule somehow bind the people when they become drunk on whatever it is, whatever crisis is going to arise. One minute. Okay. Well, that doesn't work. And I will leave out the second subheading of self. The point about if you're going to bind yourself, you're going to bind yourself to something that will bind the future interpreters and not leave because they'll see the same crisis. Maybe the most interesting kind of constitutional provision from my standpoint is the one that's designed to deal with future backsliding. The 15th Amendment may actually be an example of a constitutional provision designed to deal with future backsliding. That is to say, there was a majority that had the power to change the Constitution, the Republicans, about to lose that power as they were in the process of losing their supermajority in Congress and in the state legislatures, and who very quickly moved the 15th Amendment through both Congress and the state legislatures, proposed by a lame duck, a Congress. Well, that kind of motivation, whether you like it or not, that kind of motivation is very much one to bind the future, because the future is about to go in a bad direction. And somebody who wanted to do that would not say, oh, and we'll give the future a lot of normative authority. No, the whole point of constitutional provisions under those circumstances is to bind the future. I have run out of time without getting to the possible reasons that might cause a constitution creator to say, yes, well, perhaps to some extent it is necessary to give high-level normative decisions to be made by constitutional interpreters in the future. But since my bottom line was going to be that those considerations, although possible, are outweighed by the other ones, I'm just going to leave them out and say it would never happen on theoretical grounds.
I'm just going to ask the panelists if they want to say, I'm going to try to limit this to 2 minutes, like one point about the others' points, and I'd like to begin with Randy Barnett, but unfortunately Randy has to leave us for another panel.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mike said he had something to say about my comments, so I'll just defer to him, and if I have a response to him, then I'll say that, and then I'll leave at that point.
Okay.
I'm referring to Mike.
So why don't we, and then we'll let...
Randy agreed with everything that I said. I don't get to speak for you. No. My comment about what I was going to say about Randy. I certainly agree with Randy that we should on the one hand be happy that the Jack Balkans of the world are possibly becoming originalists, but I think there's a sort of an important point to sort of recognize here, and maybe the way to see it is to go back to the old debate, the old words we used to have. In the 80s, there would be a debate between interpretivism and non-interpretivism, right? And unless you're familiar with it, it sort of sounds very, very, very sort of odd. And then very quickly, the non-interpretivists sort of stopped calling themselves non-interpretivists. And I think it's because people recognize, boy, what is it that you're doing if you're not interpreting the Constitution, right? The sort of power grab became so obvious. One of the things that originalism really has is this sort of, the public probably believes two things about constitutional provision. They believe in originalism, I think, it's a sort of... But they also want good interpretations. And the one thing, even if you don't accept my supermajoritarian argument, the one thing that the public, that originalists have is this sort of common sense idea. Well, if now originalism is turned into something that allows for the living constitution, then and we're all now just originalists, and there's the good result originalists and the bad result originalists, then the real originalists have nothing. Right, if you're looking at it sort of politically. So I'm very worried about that move. Maybe there's sort of other alternatives. Probably that's all you have time to respond back.
Yeah, I really hate to leave this. I knew this was going to be a good discussion, and the other contributions were terrific. I do want to say that I agreed with a lot of what Mike said. This is the most... it's the most concisely I've heard this normative argument for originalism made before, the one with the supermajoritarian rules, and I'm quite attracted to it. It fills a missing piece in the normative argument I've made, or piece that I could get away. I think I don't need to fill, but if it is filled, it would be better than not having it, which is why it is that the Constitution came out as well as it did, given the way it was decided, it was enacted. I've alluded to some things like that in my work, but this is a very nice. Argument, a normative argument too, something that originalists tend not to be making well, and I think this is a good one. So I do want to say that. But as for your, I think your use of the interpretive, non-interpretivist move is actually cuts in favor of the argument I was making before. Non-originalists struck out with this distinction between interpretivism and non-interpretivism, and they found that, I think, because of the inherent power an appeal of the Constitution, and by that I mean the written one, in under glass in Washington, somewhere in this city. Because of that intuitive appeal, generally, people it did open them up to this suggestion that, if you're not an interpretivist, then what are you, and why should we pay any attention to you? And they were then moved by the force of the interpretivist argument in that direction, which was a good direction to move them in and set them up possibly for the next move, which is if you're an interpretivist, then what kind of interpretivist are you? So this is, I think that there's a name for this development, and it's called progress. And it's to be welcomed, And I think that that was a good move. That was progress. And this is further progress. And I don't doubt for a moment that Jack and others are going to resist where originalism takes them. I think conservative originalists oftentimes resist where originalism takes them, and they set up other criteria of decision making to obstruct the conclusion of an originalist analysis. But I do think ideas have consequences, and it becomes more once you've conceded a number of these premises, and interpretivism and non-interpretivism is one of them. And then if you start conceding the textualist premise and the formalist premise, and then the meaning must remain the same until it's properly changed premise, and you start admitting one of these premises after another, pretty soon it's going to add up to a commitment that there's going to be wiggle room about, but you're going to be in a different place than where you started. And I think that also is progress. I wanted to say something about Kim's book and the degree to which I think he's an originalist, but I'm not going to stick around to hear your answer to it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm just not going to do it. We'll talk about it some other time. Anyway, thanks very much. And I really, please accept my apology for having to run off like this. I hate doing so.
Don't worry, Randy, it's more beer for us.
I'm not going. I could say this. You know, you can't say about me after I left, he's gone to a better place.
It's not true.
You want to respond to?
No, I wanted to say something about Kim because I just.
Okay,
but that's fine. You can go.
But I'd like to get the questions right.
Kim,
but Kim, please.
Well, this has been great. It's been very interesting, and I think that I've learned a lot. I can't really tell you, what you as originalists should think of Jack Balkin's conversion, and whether that's disingenuous or whether it's something to be feared or not. But I can tell you, from my perspective as someone who also goes to a fair number of ACS meetings, certainly more actually than Federalist Society meetings. One of the things that people say is, isn't it unfortunate that we don't have, as good sound bites as the Federalists do? Because all of these things about originalism and fidelity are very compelling, to the layperson, and they have great political effect. I think it wouldn't necessarily be unreasonable to worry that some of the progressive embrace of originalism is tactical, right? And there is an attempt to co-opt the slogans. But on that point, really, I guess I'm just echoing what Randy said. But there is, I believe, a fair amount of intellectual integrity among the people who are doing this. And as Randy said, once you start saying these things and you start believing them, if you're intellectually honest, which I think most of these people are, I think Jack Balkin certainly is, and I aspire to be intellectually honest myself. You are led in a certain direction, and you'll go where the ideas take you. And I think that the ideas that Jack and others are embracing are good ideas. So I think probably from my perspective, we should think of this as a positive development, and we should be thinking about the degree to which we do, as I was saying, have common ground. On that specific question, right, the common ground, I got the impression that John Harrison feels that there are not as many constitutional provisions as I might think that are intended to have this flexible range of applications. I'm not entirely sure that I'm reading him or hearing him correctly on that. So that's something that maybe I'd like to have him say more about. And I guess my basic question would be, when you say, as a constitution designer, it's unlikely that you would want future interpreters to make large-scale normative judgments, my question would be, well, twofold, I guess. One, what counts as a large-scale normative judgment, and is the sort of bringing outliers into line with a national consensus that I offered as a possible explanation for why you might write a constitutional provision that does what I was saying I think equal protection does, is that a large-scale normative judgment, or is that something that you think might in fact reasonably be put into a constitution? Then the second question would be, what has the Supreme Court been doing historically in our actual history? Has it been making these large-scale normative judgments? And if so, what does our history tell us about whether that is in fact desirable or not? I mean, have things gone well if the court has been doing that, or have they not?
It's a necessary evil to deal with problems like evasion and to some extent changed circumstances, though I suspect more evasion. It's an interesting historical point that the drafters, say, of the 15th Amendment may have thought that more evasion was permissible than we did, but we can put that aside. It is certainly possible on theoretical grounds that a certain amount of fuzziness, a certain amount of standard likeness is going to be required by the Constitution drafters for that reason, and maybe especially in the kind of provision Kim was talking about. What has the court been doing, and has it been good or bad? I think that there are certainly circumstances under which the court has been doing what I don't think you would think a constitutional designer would want, and I'm in order to avoid current controversies, I'm going to say that I think what the court did from about 1880 to 1930 was, on the basis of some hints from the constitutional structure about the allocation of power, in particular the Commerce Clause, create its own theory of the way the national economy ought to operate, create its own theory of an American common market, this is primarily the Dormant Commerce Clause, create its own theory of the protection of private rights through substantive due process. And that doctrine was a mixed bag, I think, as a substantive matter. It had some positive aspects, it had some negative aspects, but it was driven by courts, and because it was driven by courts, it had a lot of the difficulties with any doctrine that you would expect to see produced by courts. So the experience with what judges have actually done is mixed. But it is certainly not. I'm not prepared to say that it is on the whole favorable, because I think the experience from 1880 to 1930, say, is an example of, well, you know, it was some good, it was some bad, and somebody else probably could have done a better job.
I just want to clarify one thing. Kim suggested that I was saying that Jack Balkin might be disingenuous here, and I didn't want to at all suggest that. I assume Jack is being genuine in thinking that this is the best understanding of originalism. On the other hand, what then happens is, you know, that originalism suddenly, you know, justifies the abortion decisions and the like. So I'm not trying to cast any aspersions on Jack. Precisely, if he's genuine in believing this, there's still very much a danger of losing the constraints of originalism.
We'll now have go to questions. We want to record the questions, and so we're going to ask people to wait for the mic to come to them. And here, and Bob Nadelson, we'll begin with Rob. Let me begin with you.
This thing on? Can you hear me? A question for Mike. I was intrigued by your argument that fidelity to the original meaning of the Constitution produces good results because the Constitution calls for supermajority decision-making. Quite a number of years ago, I was examining tax limitation initiatives in states, and they quite frequently use supermajorities as a way of controlling the burden of taxes by requiring, for example, a two-thirds vote of a legislature to raise taxes. And so I reviewed the economic literature on supermajorities, and what I discovered is that not all supermajorities are created equal, that you can that the optimal supermajority will vary according to the size of a group. You can have a supermajority which is so high that it enables a small minority to prevent optimal change. And that in general, as the size of the group gets larger, the optimal supermajority goes down. So the optimal supermajority when we had 13 states for amending the Constitution might have been a 3/4 consent among the states, where perhaps an optimal supermajority for when we have 50 states might be a good deal less than 3/4, which raises the question of whether or not, due to changes like this, you actually wind up locking us into a bad system because you have to reach supermajority requirements that are antiquated and that were optimal years ago but are no longer optimal today. I wonder if you've calculated any of that, or what reaction you
have
to that?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Let me sort of break it up into a couple of points. I mean, the first point is, that obviously it's not just any supermajority, not all supermajority rules are good all the time. It makes sense in certain circumstances, and certain kind of supermajority rules make sense, not all of them. So that's sort of first. There's some interesting theoretical questions about how strong you want the supermajority rule to be. Do you want it to be 3/4? Do you want it to be 2/3? It depends on a lot of assumptions that you make about motivations of the legislature, their accuracy in making judgments and the like. Less clear that it depends on the percentage, on the size of the body, as you're suggesting. It depends what kind of theory you're using. One theory that John and I use in a different paper is a sort of Condorcet jury theorem type theory, where we modify some assumptions, and as a result of that, you, even though Condorcet normally gets you majority justifications for majority rule, under these assumptions you get justifications for supermajority rule, and there it may actually tend matter. Under other theories, it doesn't. So it's not. So the short answer is, it's not 100% clear that with 50 states you want a different percentage than you would with 13, but might be. depends on the theory that you're using, and I guess I gotta say that I'm agnostic on that. I'm not quite sure whether I would adjust it. My tentative answer is no.
Next question. Spring around. Yes. Yes.
Oh yes, this is for Professor Roosevelt.
If you'd state your name, please.
I'm Michael Lewin from Florida Coastal School of Law. You propose, as I understand it, something like an interpretation of the Equal Protection Clause that would very much discourage outlier states. And my question is, wouldn't that freeze the status quo in place to discourage experimentation by states? So, for example, to give a notably unprogressive example, let's suppose the state of Massachusetts, or actually Massachusetts, give a less real-life example. Let's make it, I don't know, Montana. decides to create a single-payer health insurance plan. And that's challenged in the Supreme Court on some sort of equal protection argument or whatever. And so the plaintiff argues, well, this is the only state with a single-payer health insurance plan. It's an outlier, so shouldn't that be struck down?
That's a good question, and I think the answer is, you know, yes to some extent, but that freezing is going to be going on in a situation where the experimentation that's being discouraged is something that a national majority thinks is undesirable, you know, because it's discriminatory. So I'm not sure that a single payer health plan would actually give rise to an equal protection challenge. I mean, it's going to be more a situation where, you know, some minority is being treated in a way that a national majority thinks is unfair. Now, of course, it's not completely frozen, right? Because if national sentiment shifts, you know, which it could do in sort of incremental ways, you know, which aren't themselves going to be prohibited by this, then, you know, you'll get a situation where what maybe seemed unreasonable is now considered reasonable.
Of course, the problem is the shift has to be so rapid that it has to happen between the time the first state passes it and the time that goes up to the Supreme Court.
Well, no. I mean, what I'm suggesting on that point is, you know, you can have shifts that are not going to be struck down as unconstitutional, right? You can have some sort of shift in sentiment that doesn't take the form of adopting this policy that's going to be challenged as discriminatory.
Hi, my name Lee Strang from Ave Maria, and this is for Mike. Mike, your justification for originalism seems to be a lot like Randy Barnett's, and I wish he was here to respond to this question as well, in the sense that you both seem to be arguing that originalism leads to good results. And you say you just have the kind of abstract term good results. Barnett has just lawmaking procedures. And the question I would have for him, which I guess I'm going to pose to you, is what about in a situation where the original meaning doesn't present a good result? Coining monies, for example. Original meaning of Article 1, Section 8 says Congress can coin money. Most people probably think that having paper money is a good result. One man, one vote, equal protection clause, original meaning. So what do you say to a judge who could get away with, in other words, by hypothesis, the result would be a good result, inconsistent with the original meaning, but not undermine, at least in any way that would outweigh the good result of this particular case, undermine the supermajority values that come about through your justification?
Well, there's no assurances that you're going to, when you get a supermajoritarian enactment, that you're going to get good constitutional provisions. It's just a kind of theoretical tendency. You know, it's a bit like any rule that you have.
It's
a bit like any rule that you have. Sometimes, I mean, we know, certainly David Hume pointed this out, in particular cases, rules can seem to be problematic, but the reason why we follow the rules is because, in general, we get the better result. We just can't pick and choose the areas where we're not going to follow the rule because we'll lose the rule. So when the judge decides, well, here's this area where I'd like to, you know, improve upon matters, that's not the question. The question is, are we going to start making exceptions? And, you know, Judge A makes exception for case A, and suddenly Judge B makes exception for B. Now, so that's the problem. Now, I think you could have a constitution that's bad, that's so significantly bad that you might, you know, say we shouldn't be bound by it. Or, you know, those are very difficult questions, and I certainly want to admit the possibility of that going on. But where you actually have a constitution enacted by a supermajority rule, where you it generally seems to have the allegiance of the people, where it seems to be quite desirable, I think it's clear that the judges ought to, you know, suck it up in the cases where they don't agree, because otherwise you're going to go down a slippery slope or a declining cycle of judicial activism, if you will.
Todd Gaziano from the Heritage Foundation. And I'd just like a little bit more of a discussion from maybe a couple of you on the implications of the Article 5 amendment process that John alluded to in the introduction. And it seems like one way in which the previous exchange just highlights that is first of all, you would expect the supermajority rulemaking decision about Article 5 to be given some respect, but also that you wouldn't expect it to actually, that process to be followed if there is an easier method to amend the Constitution. So you wouldn't, you would expect an atrophy in the Article 5 process if judges are correcting certain thought to be constitutional defects. Do any of you all want to elaborate on your thoughts on that?
I actually think that the relationship between sort of having judges update the Constitution and Article 5 is actually something of an underexplored area and quite interesting. And one of the problems with you know having judges update is exactly as you suggest, it supersedes the Article 5 process, right? So just to give you an example, when would we actually expect there to be a supermajority, you know, adequate to amend something? Well, we'd expect it when the Constitution is really sort of out of whack with what the people want. But if you have judges doing the updating, then you're never going to get to that place because they're going to have updated it already, right? And you may say, well, no harm, no foul. The judges have updated it. But, of course, there's not necessarily any good reason to think that the judges will have picked the updating that the people would have picked. But what happens is the judges update it. It's, you know, tolerable to the people. There's not a supermajority for overriding what they've done. So they've sort of taken the decision away from the people. And now you might even say, well, the people are kind of behind this, and we ought to even – I'm actually sympathetic to saying, you know, that things that seem to be largely accepted – maybe ought not to be overturned, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't harm going on. There's a lot of other points, but let me just limit it at that.
John. Yeah, I wanna talk about this because it's a fascinating topic. And the first thing I want to say is I'm a little embarrassed as a law professor to say that here, as is often the case with respect to constitutional theory, some of the best work is done by Keith Whittington, who's a political scientist, and not a law professor who's written about both original meaning and this problem and a couple of books that are just great. And one of the things Whittington says is that because the Article 5 process is so hard to work, the American political system has developed other mechanisms for constitutional change. One of the other mechanisms for constitutional change is Supreme Court appointments. And so we get the highly edifying spectacle that we have been seeing in the last 20 or 30 years of struggles over how to change the Constitution being fought in this proxy war through the appointment of Supreme Court justices. And it's not pretty. It's not a good way to make constitutional decisions. And it screws up the court from being a court. I mean, it's a third best kind of solution. But it is driven in large part by the difficulty of the Article 5 process. And I also want to, I'm going to work in another one of the things I didn't get a chance to say and sort of maybe ask Mike to comment on it. Because one of the reasons for creating constitutional self-binding rules or constitutional entrenchment rules is it's like the law of contract. That is to say, a rule may be put into a constitution in order to induce reliance by another member, basically of a contract. And if the other member whose reliance is being induced, whose participation in the constitutional system is being induced, doesn't trust the ordinary political process because they expect to be a minority in the ordinary political process that the Constitution is creating, they will want entrenched guarantees of their interest. And that's another reason why you see constitutional entrenchment. And I think that a lot of things in the Constitution, most notably one, the two senators rule, and two, Article 5, were there to induce reliance by state-based minorities, as understood in 1787. And those are basic features of the Constitution. And yet they reflect political alignments, people's understanding of political alignments, as of 1787. And yeah, people are always thinking about the present, and they assume the future will resemble the present. And those are long since irrelevant. And I wonder whether the large case for following the Constitution on supermajoritarian grounds is to some extent undermined because very important features of it, fundamental features of it, reflected what turned out to have been evanescent aspects of the American political configuration from the time, from more than 200 years ago?
That's a very good question. I guess I would say, a couple of things. The first thing is I agree with you, John, that the sort of equal state treatment in the Constitution is, at least from a modern perspective, 200 years ago, it's maybe another story, but certainly from a modern perspective, sort of undesirable. I wish we could change it, and I think we probably can't without junking the whole Constitution. That said, I'm not 100% sure how bad it is as a practical matter. It really all depends on to what extent small states end up having different interests in the political process than large states do, and sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't, and there's some fluidity there. But certainly as a theoretical matter, and sometime as a practical matter, I think it's unfortunate that we have this feature. Does it? Anytime you have anything undesirable about the Constitution, it makes it a little bit less desirable to actually enforce the Constitution. In the end, I think you've got the real question is, maybe I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Should we go on? There's another question in the back. Yes. We have time for two more questions. Yes.
Just to follow up on the comment that John made, question that I wanted to ask particularly to Michael and in his justification of originalism. It seems to me the flaw is Article 5. Article 5, in order to really have a system that works, you've got to have an ability to change it to cope with circumstances that weren't anticipated, including decisions by the Supreme Court, for instance, such as Roe versus Wade, that are clearly illegitimate as a matter of constitutional interpretation, as well as, in that case, out of sync with the values of the people that they are imposing their rules upon. Article 5 is simply too hard. If you think of all of the amendments since the Civil War Amendment, there are very few, the most notable exception perhaps being the Prohibition Amendment and the repeal of Prohibition, that deal with any really substantive matter. The rest deal with primarily procedural or structural or more arcane kinds of issues. The ERA is a good example. Strong support for the ERA. It didn't pass. Yet the Supreme Court has incorporated the basic principles of the ERA through judicial decision making. And most people are very comfortable with the Supreme Court decisions with regard to gender equality. There are obvious, we can all fault certain examples, but I think it's safe to say that that's the country at large is pleased with that development. Article 5, it seems to me, is flawed. And second, look at what's happening in Massachusetts. The legislature there, which sits as a constitutional convention, because to get an amendment, you have to work through the established political structure in order to get an amendment in the old, mostly northeastern states, which were anti-populist, that adopted their amendment procedures at a time that democracy was a dirty word. And so it's very hard. You have to go through the established political process or system or establishment in order to get an amendment proposed, and they've blocked it and blocked it until finally this year they were shamed into allowing a vote. We'll see what happens in the next 2 years. Isn't it true, then, that the Article 5 seems to me to be the fly in the ointment to your justification for originalism?
May I just ask,
Lynn Wardle, Brigham Young University.
I've actually gone back and forth on whether Article 5 is too strict. And my current position, I guess I'd summarize this way. If there wasn't a problem of Supreme Court failure to enforce the Constitution, Article 5 is not too strict. I think the strict supermajority rules do reflect the consensus of the country. The problem, though, is judicial sort of non-enforcement of the Constitution. I mentioned before one of the ways, let me just mention another since you mentioned the Equal Rights Amendment. I think a big reason why the Equal Rights Amendment would not have passed was fear of how judges were then going to interpret it. Right? If you had a world where judges could be faithful interpreters, where people weren't scared they were going to then go off and expand, then there would be much more likelihood that the Equal Rights Amendment would have been enacted. So, on the other hand, in a world where the Supreme Court is the way it is or the way it has been, there I think is a strong argument for having a weaker supermajority for amending the Constitution, although John may or may not disagree with me.
And can I want to say something about that because I think it's quite important. And this is another one of the reasons that maybe what I said on theoretical grounds is not completely true. What Mike just said about the ERA is very interesting because it demonstrates that subsequent constitution writers in the United States realized that their constitution was going to be implemented in large measure through judicial review. And they were familiar with the agency problems associated with judicial review. And one reason we don't have the ERA is because of the agency problems associated with judicial review. The people who wrote the original constitution only had a vague notion of how judicial review was going to operate. They didn't understand it as well as we do.
Yes. Roger Pilon is next.
Yes. Roger Pilon with the Cato Institute. Mike, you've given us a new normative theory of originalism, to wit that the supermajorities tend to produce better outcomes. You were thinking of the American Constitution. I was thinking of the Taliban Constitution as you were speaking. The theory is consequentialist, and it strikes me that it cries out for what you mean by better outcomes and what you mean by normative. Does not this lead to some degree to a straightforward consent theory? Of legitimacy? Is this a theory of legitimacy, or is it a theory of wealth maximization? Is it a theory that leaves us saying that, or asking why should we be bound by the dead hand of the founders? If it's a will theory, don't we want to also be able to say something like, It's not just that this is the law they gave us, but in some sense they got it right, and therefore requires an independent theory of the normative.
It's not a consent theory. It's let's say I'm tend to be a consequentialist. It's sort of a wealth. I mean, if you ask me what my theory of normative justification would be, it's a sort of welfarist consequentialism, taking into account sort of the importance of rules. So that's how I would justify it. It's not whatever pass. So that's point one. I'll try to be brief. Point two. It's not whatever happens to pass a supermajority rule is necessarily a good thing, but I think an important part of our understanding of the goodness of something is that it has passed the supermajority. It gives us confidence in the likelihood that it is good. Tells us a lot about the degree of acceptance, the degree of acceptance of the Constitution. So, I guess I'll just have to leave it at that. Although I could go on some more.
Here's when I see two hands up. I'm just going to take the two questions one after another, and then we'll give very short answers to them. I see two hands there.
Thank you, Dennis Goyle from Catholic University, and I'd quickly say the equality of the states leans on better aspects of the Constitution. You know, one person, one vote is inconsistent with the original understanding. That's another point for originalism. But the question is if you haven't already, I hope it's not too off the wall, but does anyone want to comment on the problems of originalism in a common law political culture? So, I mean, I can see a way to rationalize consistency, but it seems to me there's a fundamental tension there that creates problems.
And there was another question like right behind you, wasn't there? No?
I had one earlier.
Well, yeah.
I was just going to follow on Lynn Wardle's point. Tuan Samahan, University of Nevada, Las Vegas. This is also about the Article 5 difficulty. Is I think that part of the problem, maybe Article 5 has become onerous, is that U.S. senators are now directly rather than indirectly elected by the state legislatures. I think perhaps an inadvertent consequence or unintended consequence of that amendment is to make certain amendments to the Constitution more difficult because of the self-interested nature of the Senate's role in that process.
Okay, any brief comments in response to either of those questions?
I think that with respect to the common law, the tension is between the common law and constitutionalism. This is another situation in which you should be thinking about the noun and not the adjective.
Well, I have one brief thing to say, I guess, about the Constitution and the common law, which is there is, I think, a sort of interesting and important tension there, but maybe the way that we should think about it is, given the flexibility and evolving nature of the common law, to the extent that the Constitution codifies or constitutionalizes certain common law concepts, maybe that would give us an additional reason to think that perhaps those are meant to be flexible in their applications.
Well, thank you very much.